DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Today on the program, the Kachin ethnic minority continues to face armed conflict in Myanmar.
They are not really targeting their enemy, the Kachin army, but, you know, they are just shelling the bombs and using the aircrafts where the civilians are staying.
Finding solutions for millions of displaced people across the world.
And the goal of the Nansen Initiative is to come up with a protection agenda, as it's called. Not so much a new treaty, but a new way of protecting essentially environmental migrants who have fled their own country because of natural disasters, including climate change.
And can justice be done? How people in Bosnia perceive the war crimes tribunal.
It became a huge international machinery, very expensive and very slow in making any decision.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. Fighting continues in the state of Kachin in Myanmar, the Asian nation also known as Burma. Now, one women's rights group is calling for international sanctions to be reimposed on the fledgling democracy because of its ongoing ethnic conflicts. The Thailand-based Kachin Women's Association claims the Myanmar army has been responsible for serious breaches of international humanitarian law. Nick Martin has more.
Here in the Thai capital, Bangkok, Julia Marib from the Kachin Women's Association Thailand, or QWOT, has been giving a talk to journalists.
Part of family are still in the area, very close to conflict area.
In a recent report called State Terror in the Kachin Hills, QWOT documented the deaths or wounding of dozens of civilians.
After 2 weeks, she went there and she found his dead body.
The group says civilian areas in the country's northernmost state were repeatedly targeted by Myanmar troops, including refugee camps for those displaced by the fighting. It's demanded an investigation into alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity, and called for international sanctions to be reimposed on Myanmar, which is also known as Burma.
They are not really targeting their enemy, the Kachin army, but, you know, they are just shelling the bombs and using the aircrafts where the civilians are staying. This is directly violating the Geneva Convention Article 3. They can fight anywhere they want, but not targeting to the civilian and also not burning the houses. This is out of the law.
Myanmar officials have denied that troops were targeting civilians. There have been reports that fighting has flared up again in spite of the latest round of peace talks. Many analysts are questioning why additional government troops have been sent to Kachin in recent days when the government says it's committed to peace. Marib says of the more than 100,000 people displaced by the conflict, not many have received international aid.
Humanitarian assistance is very needed in the China-Burma border, especially under KIO control area, because Burmese government are still some restriction. For the UN agencies and NGOs, they cannot operate freely to provide assistance in those areas.
The second Kachin conflict erupted in June 2011 when a 17-year ceasefire between the government and the Kachin broke down. The uprising is one of several long-standing ethnic battles that have been reignited since the end of decades of military rule. With 132 different ethnic groups making up 32% of the population, the transition has been fraught with fighting. Myanmar's new constitution, drafted by the military, called for all ethnic armed groups to come under a national force, which some still oppose. Other tensions involve Karen, Shan and Rohingya minorities, making Myanmar's internal conflict the world's longest ongoing war. Last year's Rakhine State riots saw more than 650 Rohingya Muslims killed, left 1,200 missing and more than 80,000 people displaced, amid claims of severe human rights abuses. In Kachin alone, an estimated 364 villages have been wholly or partially abandoned. Poit has called for US and EU sanctions, which were recently suspended, to be reimposed. The group has also requested third-party involvement in peace negotiations. Political analyst Dr. Desha Tangsifer from Thailand's Thammasat University has been pushing for the international community to get more involved to help end all of Myanmar's ethnic conflicts.
This international monitoring team would comprise the main actors like UN and ASEAN, as well as members of civil society internationally. But one thing, the core team of monitoring team must not comprise of stakeholders or conflict parties. If we want to send monitoring team into Kachin, Burma and China could not be in the core group.
Tangsifa is convinced that Myanmar's leaders have taken advantage of a thawing in international relations to quash its armed ethnic communities.
You have international community pouring in money, both in the term of foreign investment and foreign aid. The U.S. government granted a couple of $100 million. Other countries follow suit. And I'm very concerned that the money that pouring into the country as foreign aid / foreign investment, some of which might have been used to crush all those ethnic nationalities, all those dissenting voices. So this is very alarming.
Despite the sweeping changes of the past 2 years, the government is still dominated by the military. And as much as Myanmar's troubles are seen as ethnic conflicts, many continue to point to its rich natural resources, which the government is determined to secure as the country continues to open up. Nick Martin, DW, Bangkok.
Internal displacement doesn't just occur due to conflict. It can also be due to natural disasters and increasingly due to climate change effects. Scott Leckie works for Displacement Solutions, an NGO which works with communities around the world wanting to return home or to find new land and viable locations. I met up with him recently to discuss the issue. I started by asking him how many people are displaced worldwide at the moment.
At least 20 million are officially recognized as refugees, so to speak, and a much larger number are internally displaced people. That number, depending on how you define it, and particularly if you include environmental causes of displacement as well as conflict and disaster, reaches already into the many hundreds of millions. Kofi Annan's humanitarian initiative in Geneva estimated a couple years ago that there were approximately 350 million people who were displaced by environmental causes alone, so drought and severe storms, so on and so forth, climate change being one of them. So the numbers are extremely high, and unfortunately, as climate change worsens throughout the world, it's almost certain that those numbers will continue to increase.
To what percentage is climate change uprooting people and displacing them?
It's difficult to say what the percentage is, but probably overall you could quite easily say that certainly environmental factors, including climate change, are the primary generators of displacement in the world. Displacement caused by drought, displacement caused by changes in weather patterns, displacement caused by perpetual flooding where there was none before, rising sea levels, the loss of land, erosion, and a whole range of other, deforestation, a whole range of other kind of environmental factors. And add them all up, we're talking about a significant portion of the human race who is no longer able to live where they would prefer to live and where they used to live.
There's no international or any agency that takes care of climate refugees. That term even doesn't exist so far. They don't have any rights, right? And there's no agency that would put them in refugee camps or feed them.
Yeah, that's a legally speaking, we can't use the term climate refugees as such because a refugee has a certain legal definition, which means, you know, well-founded fear of persecution, usually against your own government. So probably the preferred term for these types of people is more climate migrant or climate displaced person or environmental migrant. There's a number of other phrases out there. But yeah, there's no agency specifically designated to look after these people as of yet. There have been attempts to ask the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to take on this role and a number of other agencies, but states in particular, some of the more powerful ones, are not interested in allowing them to do that. So they...
Why not?
Well, for one, it draws attention to the problem, and it begins to get people thinking about the cause of the problem, which then turns to who actually released all this CO2 into the air that led to the temperature rising 2, 3, 4, 5 degrees. And is there any liability involved in that? And should they actually, since they caused the problem, be forced to pay? States have proven, in rhetorical terms, willing to make political commitments to pay for the adaptation measures required to find solutions for a lot of these people. There's a green fund that's been agreed recently, and it's meant to have $100 billion in it per year very soon that can be allocated to people who need to have adaptation measures undertaken. At present, though, there's virtually no money in this green fund. No one knows how exactly it's going to be accessed. And for countries making oral commitments that are never backed up by actual financial commitments. So when you add it all up, if you're a climate displaced person, whose door do you knock on for assistance? And very few governments right now can answer that very simple question. Where do you go if your land is no longer viable? But there isn't really a designated person or institution within governments nor internationally who you can turn to where you can realistically expect some sort of assistance. And that's a gap that really needs to be fixed in the near term.
And do you think it has to be fixed in legal terms? Do we need a new international law for people displaced by climate events?
I think we certainly need a series of new statements and principles to be adopted at the international level that recognize clearly the rights of people who are displaced due to climate change. The Nansen Initiative is a new initiative backed initially by the governments of Norway and Switzerland and now joined by a number of other governments, including Germany very recently. And the goal of the Nansen Initiative is to come up with a protection agenda, as it's called, not so much a new treaty, but a new way of protecting essentially environmental migrants who have fled their own country because of natural disasters, including climate change.
It's like humanity is running towards a crisis that we already know, that we've caused it, but we're not doing much about it. Don't you think we need something much more general, like rethinking the world?
You know, when you look at it in very large macro-level terms of, let's say, global economic development as opposed to the development of individual countries, you know, the latest figures released by groups such as the Ecological Footprint Movement and others, you know, have clearly said that if everyone in the whole planet were to live under current conditions at the same level as people in Europe, meaning perpetual access to cars and to electricity and to all of the things that Europeans are used to, we'd require at least one other planet Earth, if not two more planet Earths. So we are on a global development path, which is ultimately suicidal. And that's really, if you want to look at things in the largest possible scale, we need to step back and reevaluate the type of economic system that we are pursuing.
That was Scott Leckie from the NGO Displacement Solutions. Still to come here on World in Progress, a report about the anniversary of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. But first, here's Andre Leslie with this week's development news.
Former Guatemalan dictator on trial. Former Guatemalan dictator Efraín Ríos Montt went on trial on Tuesday of this week on genocide charges. He's accused of ordering the killing of almost 1,800 indigenous people during his country's civil war between the 1960s and 1990s. The 86-year-old could be sentenced to 5 decades in prison if convicted. The proceedings are expected to last several months, with 130 witnesses and some 100 experts testifying. Reed Brody of Human Rights Watch said the prosecution for crimes 30 years after they had happened was, quote, testament to the courage and tenacity of victims and humanitarian organisations in Guatemala. Philippines demand better protection for UN peacekeepers. The Philippines has asked the United Nations to provide more protection to its peacekeeping forces. This after the country announced Filipino peacekeeping troops would remain in the Golan Heights on the Israeli-Syrian border after a recent abduction. The Philippines' permanent representative to the UN, Libran Cabactulan, stated grave concern over the 3-day detention of 21 Filipino UN peacekeepers in early March. Brazil tackles obesity. Brazil launched a campaign this week to combat the ballooning waistlines of its population. There are currently costs of nearly $250 million each year to treat obesity-related diseases in the country. Basic health centres will now be providing instructions on how to prevent obesity and excess weight gain, along with providing space for people to exercise and learn about healthy nutrition. A 2011 report showed that the proportion of overweight Brazilians rose from 42% in 2006 to 48.5% in 2011.
That was Andre Leslie with the development news. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, also known as ICTY, is a court of law dealing with war crimes that took place during the conflicts in the Balkans in the early 1990s. In 1993, the United Nations decided to create an international tribunal in response to mass atrocities where thousands of civilians were being tortured, sexually abused and killed. In the last two decades, the ICTY has changed the landscape of international humanitarian law. But the court has also been criticized for being ineffective, expensive and too slow. Even 20 years on, the court's work is still far from over, as DW's Pavel Schrey reports from Bosnia's capital, Sarajevo.
The city of Sarajevo lies in a valley surrounded by mountains, which in winter are covered by a thick layer of snow. For hundreds of years, its mosques, churches and synagogues stood side by side in a country famous for ethnic and religious tolerance. Bosnia in general, and Sarajevo in particular, were characterized by a religious plurality where interfaith marriage was common. But following the breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s, violence and mass killings ensued. In 1992, Serb forces besieged Sarajevo in what would become the longest siege in modern history. Sarajevo became synonymous with snipers, shelling, massacres and ethnic cleansing. It was one of the most devastated areas in the entire conflict. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, or the ICTY, was established to try those who were responsible for rape, torture, murder, and other crimes of international humanitarian law. When the court was set up two decades ago, hopes were high, says Jakob Finci, a prominent Bosnian lawyer. But he also says the court process has been long, difficult, and costly.
It became a huge international machinery, very expensive and very slow in making any decision. These days we'll have almost a decade that Šešelj is still in front of the court. One of the most famous people in the court was Milosevic, who didn't receive the sentence on the end of the day. These days we still have pending cases against Mladic and Karadzic.
Slobodan Milosevic was the Serbian president and the first sitting head of state to be indicted for war crimes. He died in 2006 while in custody and before receiving a sentence. But Mr. Finci says the main problem has been that the outcomes of the court have not met people's expectations. This is partly due to the complexity of international law, but the court also failed to inform and communicate with Bosnian, Serbian and Croatian people. Sumeja Tulic is a program officer with the Civil Rights Defenders in Sarajevo. She says the ICTY was the first impartial forum in the region to discuss human rights violations and mass killings.
The ICTY is a momentous thing that happened to us. The atrocities that occurred throughout the decades in the 19th and 20th century, they were never discussed in a public forum. So the ICTY finally was the moment when we got the opportunity to discuss about the past from a position of, you know, facts and evidence, not from a position of emotions and memories.
In Bosnia, people from various ethnic backgrounds have criticized the court for taking too long, being ineffective, being very costly, with frequent acquittals, lenient sentencing, and early release of prisoners. But Serbs and Croats particularly have criticized the court for being politically motivated and undermining reconciliation efforts. Ms. Tulic, however, much like lawyer Jakob Finci, stresses that people expect far too much of this court.
The failures that experts and citizens, associations of victims find in its work often are due to the fact that they think that the ICTY should do everything. They should capture the fugitives, they should bring them to justice, they should, you know, indict them, and then they should come to our countries and preach and convince each one of us of the truth that have been proved to be a fact in the courtroom. And that is not what the ICTY is there for, and that is not what any court is there for.
One of the other frequent criticisms of the ICTY is that it was imposed by foreign Western powers in response to external pressures. As a result, there is very little local ownership in the justice process. However, Ms. Tulic believes the externality of the court does indeed have certain important benefits.
Everybody would deem themselves as a victim here. And there are so many different sites and individuals who consider themselves victims. And their truth, in comparison to the other victim, are almost always confronting. And that would make the court less of what any court is, and more of like a forum where we show our personal truth and speak against the other one.
Despite all the criticism of the court, Alisa Muratkos of the Association of Concentration Camp Torture Survivors says that the ICTY is generally well respected. Many members of her association have given evidence in its trials.
Recently, our actually members came back from Hague Tribunal, where he actually testified in the case of Karadzic. I think actually they developed really international and very powerful tribunal. And I think that it's satisfied actually the needs of members of my association.
Twenty years after the war began here, violence is receding into memory. But the conflict between the ethnic groups continues. Many people say that things in this respect are worse now than at the end of the war. The country is in the grip of a crippling recession. Unemployment is over 40%, the government barely functions, and corruption is rife. But most of all, there is a prevailing hopelessness. And young people in Bosnia are more conscious of their ethnicity and have more hatred than their parents' generation. Law student Ana Terzic says the seeds of hatred are sown at an early age.
But it started already in our schools. I mean, I had a different history book than the others, so it's not just this war, it's our complete history that we can't find one way to look into the future.
While the ICTY continues in its efforts to deal with the atrocities of the past, many say Bosnia desperately needs a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, similar to the one in South Africa after the fall of the apartheid regime. Lawyer Jakob Finci says that this may be the only thing that will bring a lasting peace to Bosnia.
This is a part of the solution, at least to build a trust between the different ethnic groups, to build a trust between the people that it's possible to live together and to recognize what's happened to me, be recognized by the others, and I'm also ready to accept what I did to the others. Without this, it's hard to believe that we'll have real reconciliation, because in the time being, the language of hate, it still exists in our media, and without establishing the truth, will be difficult to reach reconciliation.
This is Pavel Schrey, reporting for DW in Sarajevo.
And for our last story today, we're moving to Iraq, where conflict has taken a heavy toll in all parts of society in the past decades. 10 years ago this week, the Iraq war began with an invasion of the country, and the Allies started talking about new rights and new hopes for women in the country. In reality, much of the documented evidence suggests the situation got worse. In fact, by 2007, rapes, burnings and murders were a regular occurrence. It's now provoked a new wave of women's rights activism across the country. For DW, Ashley Byrne's been speaking to one of those who puts her life on the line for other women in Iraq.
We were subjected to ethnic cleansing under Saddam's regime. We were subjected to genocide, and we were treated as second-class citizens.
That's Huzan Mahmoud, who grew up in the north of Iraq.
Unless you were close to the government, and especially during the sanction, the 13 years of destructive sanctions, really women were pushed back into their homes already. Religiosity was rising, and the conservative attitude towards women were widespread.
Huzan's speaking to us at the Imperial War Museum North in Manchester, where she's helping to launch an exhibition to mark the start of the Iraq War 10 years ago. She now dedicates her time to campaigning for women's rights in Iraq, and her inspiration for that comes from witnessing years of struggle as a child.
My family were politically active. They were involved in the armed struggle, Kurdish armed struggle against Saddam's regime throughout the 1970s until 1990s. I witnessed the first Gulf War. I did witness a lot of brutalities there. To be honest, I have no good memories about having lived there. You know, as Kurds, we were subjected to chemical bombardment, deprived from many opportunities.
It's March 2003 and the bombardment of Baghdad begins in earnest. Those for the invasion claim the people of Iraq need liberating after years of oppression under Saddam Hussein's regime. Among those they cite as beneficiaries of regime change, women and minorities like the Kurds. But in reality, things got worse for many. For Huzan and other Iraqi women, the aftermath of war was both an uncertain and frightening time.
So women were now subjected to sectarian disputes, like they were being gang raped or kidnapped or sold for ransoms of money. Also thousands of women were trafficked out and inside the country for prostitution. There's a huge rise in honor killings, so-called honor killings, and all forms of gender-based violence. Because after the invasion, straight away women were really pushed back into their homes, both because of the lack of security and because they simply have lost everything, you know.
Photographer Eugenie Dolberg trained several Iraqi women to use the camera lens to record how life has changed for them in Iraq.
So Mohammed was from Basra. She chose to call her story bitter. Basra was the centre of the cosmopolitan centre of Iraq for hundreds of thought and very progressive. And after the British came and occupied, Basra allowed many religious militias to come and really take over the city. As she saw the religious militias strip the identity from her city, she felt like her identity was being stripped from her. So she made this very beautiful, highly saturated colour of, or cityscapes, I should say, of Basra. For example, there's this picture here, which was the cultural centre in Basra, and it had a dragon, a sort of sculptural dragon on top of it.
Now
it's been taken over by a religious militia. And they've actually placed, as you can see in this photograph, a big black flag in the mouth of this sculptural dragon. And as she says, it's announcing a new kind of death. Or this is a picture of the El Karnak cinema. Now, as you can see from this image, there's nothing left but the skeletal. The religious militia bombed it, saying that they were corrupting influences of cinema. Well, here's a picture of the Corniche, which used to be full of people, and this picture is a really an empty image sitting by the sea. And she says, this place used to be full of life. I used to love walking down the Corniche, holding the hands of my children, and talking
today
to my Corniche friends. Is empty. Men and women walking together are asked to prove they are relatives or husband and wife. Now the place is full of the hum of traffic.
Conditions are still precarious for women in Iraq. Huzan and other rights activists are determined to fight for their freedoms.
We have had demonstrations for the safe streets for women, calling for their rights and for their freedoms. Events in the community and in the universities and in the workplaces to raise awareness about women's rights and to create a friendly, woman-friendly environment by involving the young people. Artistic activities, poetry reading, things like that really is to bring back the society to the norms that women are respected and that women are equal.
And Huzan says she and other women are fully aware of the risks they're taking.
Well, being a woman is risky in itself in a country like Iraq. So really, there are so many women who are not even involved in activities and they were killed. There are so many women who were simply killed for falling in love. You know, there are so many women who were killed because of defying the, you know, family codes and stuff like that. But being active, taking the risk is much more humane than just being killed for no reason.
Despite Huzan's work to raise awareness of the plight of women in her homeland and around the world, it appears full equality for women in Iraq is as distant now as it was at the start of the Iraq War 10 years ago.
And that report wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Don't forget you can have another listen to these reports and find out about other globalization topics by visiting our website at dw.de/globalization. I hope you'll tune in again next week to World in Progress. So until then, on behalf of our Bonn studio team, Eliane Giaducci, Thomas Schmidt and me, Anke Rasper, thanks for listening and goodbye.